I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
Good morning, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. The Turkish parliament is expected to vote today and give the country's military the authority to take on these separatist Kurdish rebels in northern Iraq. This is in response to attacks recently by the PKK in Turkey, killing both soldiers and civilians. The PKK has been waging a guerrilla war against Turkey for almost a quarter of a century. The U.S., the EU, and others call it a terrorist organization. This conflict is further complicating the relationship between Turkey, Iraq, and the U.S. The Kurdish region of Iraq has been much more stable and peaceful compared to the rest of the country. The Kurds are probably the best friends the U.S. has in that region of the world. Our guests have consulted with Kurdish political leaders and join us today on Radio Times to share their views about the future of Iraq, and let me introduce them to you. Ambassador Peter Galbraith served as U.S. Ambassador to Croatia and Deputy U.N. Administrator to East Timor, also the author of a book called The End of Iraq, How American Incompetence Created a War Without End. And he writes frequently for the New York Review of Books. And Peter Galbraith, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And I should add that he's giving a lecture at the Penn Law School this today at noon, and that's at 34th and Chestnut Street. That is sponsored by the Penn Program in Ethnic Conflict. And also with us is Brendan O'Leary, director of that program, also the Lauder Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania, also edited a collection of essays entitled The Future of Kurdistan in Iraq. And Brendan O'Leary, nice to have you back as well. Good morning.
Good morning, Marty.
Peter Galbraith, let me begin with you. If Turkey votes and gives approval, as apparently they are expected to do, to be able to send their troops across the border into the Kurdish part of Iraq, what do you think the Kurds would do?
Well, they certainly
it's a lot of ifs there.
They certainly will vote to do it. The question is, will they in fact send troops across the border, and where will those troops go? If it's a limited cross-border operation aimed at what Turkey believes to be these PKK camps, then I think the impact will be limited. These are remote areas. They're not controlled by the Kurdistan government. There's nothing the Kurdistan government can do about it. And so they accept that Turkey might do that. But if Turkey moves further into Kurdistan, that is, to the areas that are populated with significant Iraqi Kurdish population, then we have a very different situation. It would destabilize the one successful democratic pro-Western part of Iraq. It would do great damage to the U.S. effort in Iraq, certainly enrage the Bush administration, do great damage to U.S.-Turkish relations, which are already at a record low. Turkey, of course, is the second most populous NATO ally after the United States. It would damage Turkey's efforts to join the European Union, and it risks an uprising in southeast Turkey, which is the Kurdish part of Turkey, and which has been reconciling with the government in Ankara, but where there's enormous sympathy for their brethren across the border.
So do you think of this, Brendan O'Leary, as a kind of symbolic vote, or is it trying to put pressure on either the Kurdish government or even the U.S. to try to deal with this problem of the PKK?
It is a symbolic vote. We'll see if it has real consequences. I think we have to understand this is partly a product of internal Turkish politics. Prime Minister Erdogan emphatically won the recent elections and humiliated the military. The military need some kind of symbolic victory, and they're choosing the PKK to make their case around. Erdogan, however, has got to be very cautious for all the reasons that Peter just gave. In particular, I would emphasize that although you can invade other people's countries when you're a member of the EU, It is completely verboten to do that if you want to be a candidate of the European Union. And what would Turkey be doing? Turkey would be invading the only functioning democratic part of Iraq. It would be attacking, it would appear, in violation of international law, an established and recognized democracy. So I think Erdogan's going to think very carefully before going ahead with this.
Why doesn't the Kurdish leadership take on the PKK, Peter Galbraith?
Two reasons. First is a practical one. Where the PKK is located, is in very high mountains. I actually have been up to those mountains, not, I should emphasize, when the PKK was there, but in 1992 when another opposition group, the Iranian Kurdistan Democratic Party, was there. And to give you an idea of how different it, how difficult the topography is, in the valleys it was scorching hot, and up where the base was, it was in the snow, and it was a single winding road. And now the Kurdistan troops don't have the ability to get up there. But secondly, as Kurdistan has become more democratic, it also becomes politically impossible for its leaders to fight fellow Kurds. In the 1990s, they did. They fought alongside Turkish troops against the PKK. But now that is politically more difficult. The final point, and this is an important one, those bases probably are not the source of the problem for Turkey. We're talking as if somehow these bases were cleaned out, that the PKK problem would go away. Most of the PKK fighters are probably in Turkey. And I also think that the Turkish government blames virtually any attack on the PKK, including many that probably it's not responsible for.
Well, interestingly, you wrote in Newsweek International recently that if Turkey were to offer amnesty, the PKK problem, and I'm quoting you here, would disappear.
Yes, I think that's the case. The PKK insurrection began in 1983, lasted till 1999, cost 15,000 lives, but it was decisively defeated. And the Turkish Kurds understand that the idea of a separate Kurdish region or independent state is not possible. And also, the Turkish government has made very important steps toward improving conditions for Kurds in Turkey. So what had been an independence movement has become a civil rights movement. And the PKK has changed its own goals. It's no longer separatist. Again, it's looking for participation in the political process. Turkey won't, having defeated them, won't grant amnesty to the remnants, and that's why this problem persists. If they had amnesty, it would go away.
But do you see them as a terrorist organization, as members of the EU, as the U.S. believes?
Well, this is always the problem. One man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. But there is no question that the PKK has engaged in terrorist tactics. That it certainly has done. So I think it is appropriately labeled as a terrorist organization.
Brendan O'Leary, do you think the U.S. should do something about the PKK or do something to try to address this simmering conflict between the Kurds in the north of Iraq and Turkey?
As I understand it, and Peter may know more about this than I do, the U.S. appointed a particular military official to mediate in this dispute and to monitor and to make recommendations to both governments, both the Kurdistan regional government and the Turkish government, about how to take matters forward. And as far as I understand it, there's been a lack of energy in pursuing that particular option. The KRG is very clear that...
And who's the KRG?
Sorry, the Kurdistan regional government is very clear that in its view what is required is dialogue between the Turkish government and the PKK. They believe it's possible to have a successful peace process in Turkish Kurdistan. And I think that's definitely the case. And one thing that people may not be aware of, the Prime Minister of Turkey, Erdogan, and his party, one of the reasons they were very successful in the recent elections is because they got significant votes from the Kurds of southeast Turkey. So they know that their electoral bread is partly buttered on Kurdish votes. That gives them reasons to compromise.
Marty, if I can jump in here. Brendan mentioned General Joe Ralston, who was the former NATO Supreme Commander. And a year ago, the Bush administration appointed him as the special envoy to deal with the PKK. Obviously not meeting with the PKK, that's a terrorist group, but with the government of Turkey, the government in Baghdad, and the Kurdistan government. It was a very sensible move. Ralston's an extremely capable individual. Although I believe his mandate should have been broader, deal with some of the other issues, but he was moving forward. Now he's quit.
Quit in frustration?
It was a year-long appointment, and the administration simply allowed that appointment to lapse. To me, it's almost incomprehensible. At a time when we actually were doing something useful diplomatically, that we've now just dropped the ball. And that, frankly, has been so characteristic of what's been happening in Iraq.
But the Kurdish region of Iraq is more stable, more peaceful, more, I guess, friendly towards the United States. Does that require a whole different set of policies to deal with the Kurdish part of Iraq compared to the rest of the country?
Absolutely. The main point about the Kurdish region of Iraq is that it's not Iraq. Brendan and I have gone there many times. Now you can fly in on Western Airlines. You land at an airport. You need a visa to go to Iraq, but you don't need a visa to go to Kurdistan.
Is that right?
The flag that flies at the airport is the Kurdistan flag. The Iraqi flag is banned in Kurdistan. It is protected by the Kurdistan Army. The Iraqi Army is banned from going there. The Iraqi government has no presence. Basically, it has all the attributes of an independent state except international recognition. It's one of the most pro-American places in the entire world. It's stable. I think, probably be a stretch to say that it was democratic, but it's trying to move in that way. It has a increasingly free media. There's a more political expression. It is a genuine success story, and not really a success story from the 2003 invasion, but from 1991, when the U.S. protected the Kurds after a failed uprising.
And Brendan O'Leary, does the rest of Iraq know that there is no Iraq in what is the Kurdish region of the country?
The rest of Iraq is divided. Some parts of Iraq want to emulate Kurdistan. That's true of some of the Shia parties in the south. They see that Kurdistan has been a success story, and they want to take advantage of Iraq's constitution to build an equivalent region. That kind of sentiment is not found among Sunni Arabs, where the Kurds are regarded as collaborators with the Americans and traitors to the idea of Iraq. But the remarkable thing is that the Kurdistan Regional Government has decided not to go for independence, despite all the temptations and all the historical reasons why it may choose that option. Instead, it wants to make a federal Iraq work, but a federal Iraq on its terms, one which makes the Kurdistan region more or less independent in domestic policy.
So it's not part of Iraq, but it is part of Iraq.
Kurdistan has all sorts of reasons for preserving the shell of Iraq. It doesn't want to have Iranian invasions. It doesn't want to have Turkish invasions. It wants to be able to export its oil when that's functioning. It has good, sensible, strategic reasons to have trade relations with the rest of Iraq. And given that it has, under the Constitution, full domestic autonomy on everything that matters, there's no real imperative to become an independent state.
We're about a minute away before our first break, but I wonder, looking briefly at the history of Iraq, Peter Galbraith, if you look at nation building, what was done for Kurdistan, which was this no-fly zone in the 1990s and the time that it took to create a functioning region of the country, compare that to the rest of Iraq, invaded in 2003 and in a pretty big mess today. Is that two lessons in nation building, one successful, one not?
Well, the fundamental problem is that Iraq is not a nation. It was put together by the British and held together by force. And once the U.S. troops came in, we destroyed all the institutions that held it together. We got rid of the last of the Sunni dictators. We dissolved the Sunni-dominated bureaucracy, allowed looters to destroy it. We defeated and dissolved the army, and the country fell apart. The key difference between the North and the South is that in the North, the Kurds did it themselves, and in the South, we tried to have an American administrator, Jerry Bremer, come do it, and he couldn't.
I want to pick up on that, but a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Ambassador Peter Galbraith, who joined us along with Professor Brendan O'Leary. We are talking about Iraq once again and getting a perspective about the Kurdish region of Iraq, and both of our guests have worked as advisors with Kurdish leaders, and lines are open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY is provided by Rutgers Camden, celebrating the 20th anniversary of its nationally accredited Master of Public Policy and Administration program. On Thursday, October 18th, Rutgers Camden will host the Richard C. Goodwin Lecture in honor of Ethel Lawrence, titled Saving Our Cities, Imperative or Impossibility. Details for the Goodwin Lecture on Thursday, October 18th are available online at camden.rutgers.edu.
It's day five of a seven-day membership drive here at WHYY 91 FM, and we have a challenge on Radio Times from the Independence Foundation. If we hear from 800 listeners before the end of this drive, which is Friday night, they will give WHYY an additional $10,000. So why not meet that challenge and make a phone call right now at 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at whyy.org. Thanks.
U.S. Artists American Fine Art Show supports WHYY. From October 19th through 21st, more than 5,000 paintings, sculptures, and works on paper from 55 exhibitors will be on display and for purchase at the 33rd Street Armory. Produced by the Women's Board and presented by Pitcairn, U.S. Artists benefits the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. Tickets at www.usartists.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The Kurdish region of Iraq has been relatively peaceful, stable since the U.S. invasion of that country. When Saddam Hussein was in power, the region was protected by a no-fly zone. Well, this tranquility could be disrupted by conflicts with Turkey because of attacks on soldiers and civilians by a Kurdish separatist group known as the PKK. We are looking at the relationship of the Iraqi Kurds to the rest of their country and to their neighbor, Turkey. And I will reintroduce our guest, Ambassador Peter Galbraith, served as ambassador to Croatia, deputy UN administrator to East Timor, author of a book called The End of Iraq, published last year, subtitled How American Incompetence Created a War Without End. And he's speaking at noon today at the Penn Law School at 34th and Chestnut Streets in Philadelphia. And this talk is sponsored by the Penn Program in Ethnic Conflict. The director of that program, Brendan O'Leary, our other guest, he's the Lauder Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania, edited a collection of essays titled The Future of Kurdistan in Iraq. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I wonder, Brendan O'Leary, as you look at Iraq today, and much was made about the surge, the increase in U.S. forces in certainly the central part of Baghdad or of the country, what you make of whatever progress has been made on the ground in Iraq?
I think the surge has had an impact. I think it's prevented the Shia Arabs from decisively winning the Arab civil war in Iraq, but I think it's probably only postponed that. I think one of the reasons for the reduction in conflict is simply the sheer success in sectarian cleansing that has taken place in parts of Baghdad, so that there aren't mixed populations to terrorize and kill anymore. I think one of the byproducts of the surge is the likelihood that particularly Sunni Arab insurgents will regroup and probably try and engage in destabilization campaigns in Diyala and perhaps in Kirkuk Governorate. Mm. But the main difficulty with the surge is, as Peter was saying earlier, is the absence of a linkage between the surge and a political strategy. The only political strategy that will make Iraq work in any way is to implement the existing constitution, to federalize it. And federalization implies federalizing security, each of the regions having their own security forces. The American ambition still seems to be to create a unified Iraqi security force, which will be uniformly accepted throughout the country, and that's an impossible ambition.
Maliki has not been able to meet Peter Galbraith any of the benchmarks. Is that because of his incompetence as a leader? Is there something about that position within the government that doesn't give him the kind of authority, or the fact that he's trying to govern a country that's at war with itself?
It's very easy to dismiss the Iraqi political leaders, including Prime Minister Maliki, as fractious and unwilling to compromise and lazy, wanting to take a month-long vacation in August.
But kind of when U.S. Congress goes on vacation, but you
we
know,
won't go into those details. Inconvenient points, or the president's in Crawford. But the fact is, they're actually hardworking, serious people. They're also democratically elected representatives of their constituents. And the problem is that what their constituents do not share a common vision of Iraq or even a common Iraqi identity. So the Shiites voted 90% for Shiite religious parties who believe that because the Shiites are the majority, they're entitled to rule Iraq and to define it as a Shiite state. And for the Sunnis, who had run Iraq from its founding until 2003, even those who dislike Saddam Hussein, they cannot accept that his Iraq is defined by a branch of Islam that excludes them, that is not their branch. And furthermore, they see the Shiite parties that are in power as being closely aligned to the great national enemy, Iran. Right. And the Kurdish vision of Iraq is a country that does not include them. And so these leaders are unable to agree because their constituents disagree so sharply on many of these questions. And that in many ways is at the root of it. But the other point is that the benchmarks Even if they were all met, it wouldn't do any good.
Why
because
not?
The
Why
war
not?
Is not being fought. The Sunni insurgents did not start this war for a share of the oil revenues, which incidentally everybody agrees that they should have a share proportionate to their population. And they're not fighting for amnesty. Amnesty usually is what happens at the end of a war when somebody's lost. They, of course, think they're winning. The issues are fundamental. It goes, again, to this definition of what is Iraq, the Shiite view that their majority entitles them to rule, the Sunni view that they cannot accept an Iraq ruled that way. And those are the core issues, and there's no resolution to those.
I wonder to you, Brendan O'Leary, whether we're also talking about a more radicalized country as it exists today, because you've got 2 million people who have fled, many of them living in Jordan, Syria, neighbors of Iraq. My understanding, these tend to be the people with the wherewithal to leave a country and perhaps the education and professional skills that a country might need. Are we left with a more extreme population in Iraq?
Well, you are partly left with a more extreme population, but you're also left deeply, sadly, with far more homogenized populations in given regions. And that's why it makes even more sense to try and implement the program of the Constitution, which allows the different parts of Iraq to have maximum self-government. I agree with Peter, there is no possibility of having anything resembling a unitary Iraqi nation state. There is no shared Iraqi identity. That doesn't mean that there might not be pragmatic reasons for the three major communities and others to remain linked in a loose federation. And that program is embedded in the Constitution of Iraq of 2005. And remarkably, the Bush administration, despite having that constitution on the table, tries to prevent its implementation. It's the one piece of good news of the last three or four years, in my view.
Is there a country, Peter, that you can look to and say, you know, here's an example of a loose federation of republics knitted together and with a lot of autonomy in its regions?
Well, I suppose the one successful example of this is Switzerland, which has a very decentralized system, although it's not apparent, I think, to most people. But the fundamental problem, Iraq, I think, basically resembles Soviet Union, Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, artificial states put together by force, held together by force, where a substantial part of the population never wanted to be included, and once democracy came, wanted out. And I think that there's a simple rule that where you have people in a geographically defined area who don't want to be part of a state, you really can't keep them in it unless by unacceptable force, which is not possible anymore. So I think the breakup of Iraq is inevitable. I think I would put a different emphasis on what Brendan has said. I think for the time being, yes, the leaders of these communities see a reason to stay together. But the moment the opportunity exists to exit, the Kurds will certainly exit. The question is, how will the dispute between the Sunnis and the Shiites be resolved?
And how do you think?
What I'm afraid of is it will be resolved by the civil war being fought to its conclusion, which means that the Shiites will prevail over the Sunnis, and Baghdad will become a purely Sunni, a Shiite city, and the Sunnis will have an enclave in Anbar and maybe up around the city of Mosul. If it would be much better to have a negotiated solution, real power sharing, in which you had a Shiite and Sunni region and perhaps either figured out a way to share or divide Baghdad. But I'm afraid that isn't going to happen.
I've talked with Peter Galbraith about what would happen if the U.S., when the U.S. leaves Iraq. What's your vision of that, Brendan O'Leary?
Well, I think it's absolutely vital when you're thinking through that scenario to ask in what manner will the U.S. leave? Would it just simply quit in an irresponsible way, in which case the obvious conclusion is a deepening of the civil war until somebody has won? I think in those circumstances, Kurdistan's priorities will be to ensure that it does nothing to tempt any Turkish or Iranian invasions. And they have long experience of being autonomous on their own, but in a scenario where things break up and there's no partner for them in Baghdad, then they'll think about independence. Mm. But only then. I think their priority for the moment is trying to make Iraq work as best they can.
I'm sure you've heard the scenarios from some who say, Peter Galbraith, that, you know, when the U.S. leaves, the country's just going to implode, that it's going to become even more violent and lawless than it is today. What do you imagine?
Well, there are many scenarios. The president has portrayed a couple of scenarios, in fact. The first, the notion that the terrorists would win. I think he's invoking almost an image of the fall of Saigon, and Osama bin Laden somehow will emerge from his cave and be standing there atop this enormous unfinished U.S. Embassy as the helicopters leave the roof.
I can see that image, yes.
And the other, which is more recent, is that somehow the Iranians will win. The fact of the matter is Iraq, after an American departure, frankly after an American defeat, will look pretty much like Iraq does today. Independent Kurdistan, de facto independent Kurdistan, a Sunni-Shiite civil war with Iran's best friends being the government of Iraq. The worst has already happened. There's not the slightest chance that the so-called terrorists can win. They represent less than the Sunnis, which are their base. Remember, the Al-Qaeda has no support among Shiites. Al-Qaeda considers Shiites apostates. They've been murdering them. So there's no base there. They don't have any support among the Kurds. Their support is a fraction of that 20%, which is Sunni. And there's no way that they can prevail over the Shiites who today control the Iraqi army and police. So that scenario is not going to end, and the Iran scenario has already taken place.
Well, let me ask you a follow-up. We were talking about this before the show, but I want listeners to hear what you have to say, Peter, which is that the U.S. made much of the fact that Sunni tribal leaders who had been supporting al-Qaeda turned to the United States and said, let's work together to get rid of al-Qaeda. What did you make of that? And many military political leaders saw this as a sign of success, that that Iraqis were turning against al-Qaeda and turning to the United States. How do you see that scenario?
Well, it's important to understand that this was a very dramatic change of strategy. The previous strategy had been to work with the Iraqi army as our partner in fighting al-Qaeda, and that meant working with a Shiite-dominated institution. And so the Sunnis in Anbar and other areas faced between a choice between the Shiites, who had death squads who were killing Sunnis, and al-Qaeda, which was fighting the Shiites, aligned with al-Qaeda. Now, we've more or less removed the Iraqi army from the equation, and we've created Sunni militias who are loyal to the traditional power structure in these areas, and they no longer have to worry about fighting the Iraqi army. They're in charge, and they can fight the al-Qaeda elements who challenge their power. So it's a successful strategy, but it's also one that is part of this process of breaking up Iraq.
But is there also a danger that they could turn on Shia militias down the pike?
Certainly. And if the Iraqi government tries to exercise authority to impose its will in that area, they will resist.
How do you see this, Brendan? Then we'll get to our caller.
Well, the only positive scenario that could emerge is that if those Sunni Arab militias that are under traditional tribal command were to be converted into the local police of a Sunni Arab region, then one would see the consolidation of an Iraqi federation that might work. But as it stands, as Peter suggests, there's a kind of incoherence. We have the Americans supporting a Sunni Arab militia that before long will want to contest power with the Shia-dominated army in large parts of Arab Iraq.
That's Brendan O'Leary, also with us. Peter Galbraith, we are talking about Iraq and some of the many challenges inside the country, and also getting a perspective on the Kurds living in the north part of Iraq. And we've got a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get George from Chestnut Hill to join us. George, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Very interesting conversation. I'm an American businessman, and I've been doing business in southeastern Turkey for about 27 years. And I probably spent about a third of my life during that period in exactly this area in southeastern Turkey that I think is relevant today. In terms of a Kurdistan extending out of Iraq and into Turkish territory, there's a bottom line reality, and I think it would be clear to your speakers, and that is that the Turkish government will never, under any circumstance, give up a single inch of land. And from my point of view, on behalf of the Kurds living in eastern Turkey, this is not a cause that the U.S. needs to promote or indicate any kind of waffling on, because it would only lead to an enormous amount of suffering on the part of those people, who, I might add, are doing a pretty good job of integrating into Turkish society.
Peter Galbraith, you want to comment on George's comments?
Well, I think George has it Exactly right. There is no chance of Southeast Turkey breaking away from Turkey. The PKK effort, which was aimed at doing that, only brought great misery to that part of the country. And so the Kurdish struggle in Turkey has to be understood in terms of a civil rights struggle, the right of Kurds to speak their own language, which was banned until the late 1980s, the right to have schools in their own language, broadcasting, things that Turkey is now doing, partly mm-hmm. under pressure from the European Union. I think it's important to understand, though, that the Kurds in Iraq have no ambitions beyond their borders. They understand this reality, but more importantly, they're a small place. It's some 4 million people with their own leaders. If there were a greater Kurdistan, they would be just one small province in something that had 25 million. That's not very appealing. So the notion of greater Kurdistan is not realistic. It's also not really desired, at least from the point of view of Iraqi Kurdistan.
You want to add to that?
I agree with Peter entirely that a greater Kurdistan is not on the agenda. One of the byproducts of the war between the PKK and the Turkish government was the dispersal of the Kurdish population outside of its historic heartland in the southeast. So there are now large numbers of Kurds in western Turkey for whom the priority is precisely equal citizenship and equal civil rights, particularly over language rights. And it's important to recognize that most Kurdish movements have transformed themselves over the last 20 years in virtually every major state into being either autonomy movements or cultural rights movements, not independence movements, and certainly not movements for the construction of a greater Kurdistan. George is correct.
I wonder, back to you, Peter Galbraith, I'm assuming eventually U.S. troops will be leaving Iraq, do you think there's a role that they could play, or is there a place that they could be in the Kurdish region of Iraq where they would be welcome?
Yes.
Like military bases of some sort there?
I think this is one of the reasons why it's so useful not to think of Iraq as a single place, even for those who want to end the Iraq war and get out. There is a part of the country that is successful. It fought on our side in the 2003 war. I think we have a moral debt to people who were on our side, even if one disagreed with the war. But it is also a place where the population is very pro-American, where they would welcome U.S. troops. The government, the elected government, wants to have a small U.S. troop presence there. That presence, and I'm thinking in the range of 10 or 20,000, would serve as a deterrent to Turkey, to Iran, to Arab Iraq. It would also be a base from which we might be able to move back into the Sunni areas if we needed to go after al-Qaeda, because I think that the one remaining achievable objective that we have in the Arab parts of Iraq is to disrupt al-Qaeda. I think these new Sunni militias is making some progress, but we can't guarantee that will stay on course, particularly if the Sunni-Shiite war escalates. Then the Sunnis may coalesce again, the al-Qaeda element and the tribal element. And so we do want to be able to do that. So we serve our interests. We preserve the success that has been achieved in Iraqi Kurdistan, and we discharge a moral debt at a relatively low cost.
We'll tell you what, a very short break, then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Ambassador Peter Galbraith, also with us, Professor Brendan O'Leary. We are talking about Iraq and the role that the Kurds have played in that country, and as our guests have said, the role that they play is as a separate part of a group within that country as well. Hard to sometimes find the language to describe what we're talking about. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Penn State's Professional Development and Counseling Series supports WHYY, offering year-round classes for counselors, psychologists, and social workers. Classes in Philadelphia start November 2nd. Details at outreach.psu.edu/counseling.
Pennsylvania Ballet supports WHYY and presents Dracula at the Academy of Music October 26th through November 3rd, featuring an audience costume contest at 8 p.m. on October 31st and a post-performance Halloween party. Dracula, with a score by Franz Liszt, choreography by Ben Stevenson, and special effects that include flying vampires and pyrotechnics. For tickets and details, 215-893-1999 or paballet.org.
The clock is ticking down on the fall membership drive here at 91 FM. Just a few days left before it is all over, and just enough time to make a pledge of support right now at 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at whyy.org. We have a very generous challenge from the Independence Foundation. They will give $10,000 to WHYY if we hear from 800 listeners during Radio Times this week. So make that call and make it count, and thank you very much.
The Atwater Camp Museum and eight area cultural organizations support WHYY and present William Penn's Welcome Week, October 13th through 21st, celebrating 325 years since Penn's arrival. Details at ushistory.org/Penn.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking about Iraq and the Kurds today in the show with Ambassador Peter Galbraith. Former ambassador to Croatia, was the deputy UN administrator to East Timor, author of a book that came out last year called The End of Iraq, How American Incompetence Created a War Without End. Also with us, Brendan O'Leary, the Lauder Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania, edited a collection of essays entitled The Future of Kurdistan in Iraq. He's the director of the Penn Program in Ethnic Conflict. And Peter Galbraith will be giving a lecture sponsored by this group at the Penn Law School at 34th and Chestnut Streets today at noon. And we've got calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. We've got Wolfgang from Princeton. Good morning. Welcome to Radio Times.
Yes, good morning, to you all. Good morning, Peter. Good morning, Brendan.
Good morning, Wolfgang.
Good morning, Wolfie.
Excellent work. I wanted to raise the specter here a little bit.
Go ahead.
There are reports about increasing foreign intelligence service activities in Iranian Kurdistan in order to stimulate self-determination drives there. And I wondered how they, your two guests, would evaluate this triangular relationship, Iraq, Turkey, Iran.
Iraq, Turkey, and, Iran.
And what that would mean if we become more engaged in a Turkish northern Iraqi Kurdish issue with violence, what that would mean for the stability of the northwestern territories of Iran.
Wolfgang, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Just to further complicate our conversation, should I toss that back to you, Peter Galbraith, and then we'll turn to you, Brendan O'Leary.
Well, this is an enormously complicated problem that Wolfgang has raised. In Iranian Kurdistan, the events in Iraq have had a very significant impact. For example, when Jalal Talabani, a Kurd, became president of Iraq, there were huge demonstrations in Iranian Kurdistan, which were very brutally put down by the regime. The demands of the Iranian Kurds are for autonomy. So it's different from Turkey, where it's civil rights, different from Iraq, where it's eventually people want to have their own state. But it could change, actually, to being a separatist, particularly as the regime cracks down. There are some mainstream Iranian Kurdistan opposition parties, the Kurdistan Democratic Party and Komala. And then there's an offshoot of the PKK called PAJAK.
PJAK, right?
PJAK. And while the PKK is on the U.S. and EU terrorist list, PJAK is not. And there are reports that the U.S. has been providing assistance to them as a way of undermining the Iranian regime, and that it's been supporting other Iranian groups, including some armed groups. Now, I have no way of knowing whether those reports are true or not, and I certainly hope they're not, because it's not going to provide effective assistance to the Kurds, and at the margins, it's not going to do anything to undermine the Iranian government, but it will get a lot of people hurt. I don't know what's going on, but there are a lot of these rumors that you hear if you're in Iraqi Kurdistan.
But other people believe this is going on, right?
Well,
and I don't know whether, you know, rumors in fact, which one wins out.
Well, the important point is that the Iranians believe this is going on. And so this fuels much of their action, their pursuit of nuclear weapons, and perhaps some of what they might be doing in supplying weapons to insurgents in Iraq who are using them against U.S. troops may be retaliation for what they see as U.S. sponsorship of violence against Iran. Now, I'm not saying that we're doing that, but they believe we're doing that, and if we shouldn't be doing it, and we ought to be thinking of ways that we can persuade, that show them that we're not doing it.
Do you want to add to that, Brendan O'Leary?
Well, I think it just goes to the point of the incoherence of America's policy towards Iran. The byproduct of removing Saddam's regime was definitely going to be that Tehran was going to be very happy with the new Iraq. And it is very happy with the new Iraq. It's governed by a Shia-led majority. Mm-hmm. And relations between Tehran and the Kurdistan government have generally been quite good. So if the U.S. is engaged in any kind of adventurism, playing fire with Turkish, with Kurdish nationalism in Iran in order to irritate the Iranian government, that really is very foolish indeed, because Iran could be a constructive ally in the federalization of Iraq. Now, when we look at the position of Iranian Kurds, Peter's quite right. Their priority is autonomy. Unlike Turkish governments, Iranian governments in the past have recognized a separate entity. There is a Kurdistan province in Iran. But under the rule of the Ayatollahs, they have gone back to some extent on their previous willingness to accept linguistic autonomy. There isn't proper rights for Kurds in educational institutions to develop in their own languages. So if the Iranian government is foolish, it will antagonize its Kurdish population, which has the example of the Kurdistan government in Iraq across the border for political stimulation.
Let me pick up on a couple of things there that you've written, Peter Galbraith, about Iran and Iraq, and you talk about or write about when the Shia were told to rise up in 1991 by George Herbert Walker Bush, president at the time. The U.S. essentially turned its back, but Iran showed sympathy, as you wrote, and perhaps that sympathy helped to cement, in spite of the history there, cement the relationship between the Shia in Iran and the Shia in Iraq.
It's a measure of how stunningly ill-prepared we were when we launched this war.
Because we didn't know that history, or we didn't understand the implications of
that? We didn't think
it
was the neoconservative architects of this war didn't think any of this was important. First, you'd had the situation where Iran had supported the Iraqi Shiite parties for decades. The largest Iraqi Shiite party, which was known as the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, was founded by Khomeini in Tehran in 1982. Its militia, which now dominates the Iraqi army, put there by the Americans, was founded by the Iranians, financed by the Iranians, armed, trained, and officered by the Iranians. So we, in effect, have handed Iran its greatest strategic triumph in 400 years. I go back to the Treaty of Khazari-Shirin, which defined the current boundary between what is now Iran and Iraq. But the architects of the war, all they thought of was that the Shia conscripts had fought loyally for Iraq in the Iran-Iraq war, although they hardly had any choice. And they also forgot about the uprising in 1991. I think one of the most awful things that has happened, that our country, frankly, has done. The first President Bush called for an uprising of the Iraqi people.
And this was shortly after the...
During the Gulf War, 15th of February. That 2 weeks later, that uprising actually took place. And then the policymakers in Washington said, oh, my God, it might lead to an independent Kurdistan, and it might lead to pro-Iranian parties taking over southern Iraq. So they allowed Saddam to put down the uprising, which he did with great brutality. 300,000 Shiites died between March and September of 1991. It was more or less a screw-up, but every Shiite thinks that it was intentional. That is, we called for the uprising, deliberately allowed Saddam to put it down, to violate the ceasefire, to use his helicopters, to send his tanks right past American lines. And the irony is that the end result of our failing to help the uprising is that here we are, 16 years later, we have an independent Kurdistan, mm-hmm. and we have a Iranian-dominated, a pro-Iranian Iraq. The very things that we were afraid of, that may not have occurred if we had allowed that uprising to succeed. If we'd simply told Saddam not to move his troops, he might have been gone in 91.
So Iran is the big winner?
Iran is the big winner, but it's not the only winner. The Kurds and the Shia are the winners. They were the victims of Saddam. They became political allies. They wrote Iraq's constitution together. And the logical thing is to allow them to extend their alliance. But remarkably, the Bush administration is still trying to push for its old goal of having a centralized Iraq as a balance against Iran. It's an impossible vision.
Well, you mentioned, you both of you mentioned this before, but then under that scenario, what happens to the Sunnis? As you said, if you can negotiate some kind of resolution, they'll get a piece of something.
Under the Constitution, there is no discrimination against Sunni Arabs. They will get a proportional share of federal institutions. Under existing agreements, they will get a proportional share of oil. They will be able to govern themselves in their own provinces, to have their own security, to have their own educational system. They need not have any version of Islam imposed on them because of the way the Constitution is set up. Regions will be able to be preeminent in the way in which the law is administered in their own domains. So if Sunni Arabs could accept a world in which they will merely be autonomous within Iraq rather than the top dogs, the war is over.
But to convince people that you're no longer the top dogs, when you benefit,
when you have been the top dogs, it's grandly. Extremely difficult. Formerly dominant minorities find it extremely difficult to adjust.
And don't they often try to overthrow
They carry out coups. They try to restore their power through reactionary means, of course. That's what we're witnessing.
But can they be placated under this scenario?
I think they can only be placated once they've worked out that they cannot win. And I think that realization is dawning on at least some of them. That's clearly the case with some of the Sunni Arab leaders in Anbar. It's certainly clear of their secular political leaders, who are a small number. It remains to be seen whether the full mainstream Sunni population accepts that fact.
The Iraq war is already in the top seven most deadly civil wars since 1945. And scholars who have looked at those civil wars basically observe that about 80% of them end with one side prevailing militarily, and only about 10 to 15% end with power-sharing agreements. What Brendan and I are advocating, and what's in the Iraqi Constitution, is a power-sharing arrangement. But I'm afraid I'm not very optimistic that we'll get to that result. And so I think partition is preferable to one side crushing the other. But the tragedy is that probably one side will crush the other.
But interestingly, we're in the middle now, I guess, of a presidential race in the U.S. I'm looking back at you, Peter Galbraith, and really Senator Joe Biden of Delaware is really the only one, it seems, that has picked this up in a very specific way and talked about it the way the two of you are talking about.
Well, Joe Biden, who's chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, in addition to a presidential candidate, is one of the Congress's great foreign policy experts and, I think, hands down the most informed person on Iraq. And he has come to the conclusion that a unified state is impossible, and he's promoted the notion of simply implementing the Iraqi constitution, which, again, recognizes Kurdistan as a region, allows the other parts of the country to form their own self-governing regions. He's not alone, though. He's joined by Sam Brownback, who is a
Republican
long-shot presidential candidate. But Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have also voted for his position. And both of them have versions of this idea. And Senator Clinton has spoken, even though she would also withdraw from Iraq over time, she would keep some troops in Kurdistan. So I think there is an emerging consensus around this idea that the country is broken up, that we can't put it back together again, and that we ought to focus our efforts on the mission we can accomplish, which is protecting our friends who are the Kurds and disrupting al-Qaeda. And at the same time, by the partition of Iraq, limiting Iran's influence to part of the country as opposed to the whole country.
That's Peter Galbraith, who joins us along with Brendan O'Leary, and I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty, and welcome to Pledge Central, folks. I hope you enjoyed that first hour of Radio Times, and coming up in the second hour, novelist Alice Siebold is in the house and getting ready for her interview with Marty. And we're in day five. I just want to remind you, you're in day five of a shortened drive, 7 days, and we are working on a big challenge. I'm Alan Tu, and with me is Susan Greenbaum.
Good morning.
Both of us are producers for Marty. And the Independence Foundation has challenged 800 listeners of Radio Times over the week to sign up and become a member of WHYY. And if we can reach that goal of 800 by the end of Friday for Radio Times, that's going to be 12 noon Friday, they will kick in an additional $10,000. Of course, that means each and every one of your phone calls and pledges is going to be going a little bit further because they're adding a little bit of money for that.
That number to call is 1-888-345-9499. Don't forget, you can also pledge online at WHYY.org. Alan, we've just heard an interesting conversation with actually two of the country's most foremost thinkers on the issue of the Kurds in Iraq,
right, exactly,
and Iran. In hour two, as we always do, we're going to switch gears a little bit. And actually, we're going to switch gears significantly.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to talk with writer Alice Siebold. And those of you who are readers know that she is the author of The Lucky Bones, The Lovely Bones, I'm sorry, and her memoir, Lucky. And she has a new book called Almost Moon, which is quite interesting. It's a fascinating story. It's a little dark, but interesting. And if you listen to Radio Times day in, day out, you know this is Marty's strength, is that her ability to move from topic to topic to cover things as important as the war in Iraq and politics and government, and then to talk with writers and artists and athletes and all kinds of people.
Oh, it's great.
We're hoping you do appreciate this programming, that you will make sure it survives and thrives and it's here for a long time to come. Hoping you'll take a moment to give us a call at 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. And Alan did mention that we are in the throes of a very significant challenge for us. And that is, if we hear from 800 members by Friday at noon, the Independence Foundation will give WHYY $10,000, which is a rather significant amount of money for us. So please do be part of that challenge. Make your membership go even further. That number to call is 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org.
All right, and we still have a lot of work to do. We've got over 100 towards that goal, but the overall goal for Radio Times is going to be 800, and that is by what? By
Are
Friday,
you saying 700
12 noon.
Calls
a
between
A little
now.
Bit less than 700,
okay.
But I mean, it's,
we could do that.
You know, and without a doubt, the last day, you know, we hopefully will get quite a bit, but we need your phone call right now in this break because we take very short breaks during Radio Times.
Now here we have a Wednesday special, folks.
Oh, we got a Wednesday
if
special.
If you become a member of WHYY at the $50 level or more.
I like that level.
And ask for it, we'll send you a WHYY tote bag, which I would like one of those.
They keep talking about these special microfibers. I keep listening in the morning.
Well, I heard someone say, like, is it like real microfiber? I'm not sure what real microfiber is. But anyway, 1-888-345-9499.
I think it doesn't really rip.
Maybe that's it. WHYY.org. Folks, it's important that we hear from you now. We are in the throes of a really significant challenge. It means a lot to us.
It means a lot to Marty, too.
It means a lot to you, too, because when you become a member of WHYY, you are part of a community of folks who understand the importance of public broadcasting.
You know, everybody I've met that listens
to
WHYY,
yeah.
I like them. I mean, I like the